3 Mile Island. It's been 44 years since the March 28, 1979 meltdown and radiation release at the 3 Mile Island nuclear reactor near Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Since then, we've been whipsawed by the nuclear industry's claims that it was no big deal, nobody died at 3 Mile Island. But the truth of what the U.S.'s largest nuclear accident to date did to people and the environment is much more human and complex than the facts, stats, and figures that are cited. So when an eco-feminist professor takes aim at finding that larger truth, and she immerses herself in the affected community to learn about what happened, and she tells you,
"What did those people have to live through?" Because that's, we don't ever hear about that. You know, it's a very male version of history. The technical, the business. How did president react? Very factual, like this happened on this day and this happened on this day. But what really happened is the people who lived there and what they had to experience. And there's very little information about that.
Well, now there's a whole bunch more, because that's what the film Radioactive, The Women of 3 Mile Island, is all about. So when Professor Heidi Huttner, producer and director of that film, points out the missing human piece in our understanding of the nuclear accident's aftermath, you get a different perspective on the problems we face and continue to face from that terrible seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at 3 Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, an interview I looked forward to and relished. We talk with Heidi Huttner. Her day job is as a professor of literature, sustainability, women's and gender studies at Stony Brook University. But her driving passion was to make a film, Radioactive, The Women of 3 Mile Island. This already award-winning documentary has a rapidly expanding future. And we talk with Heidi about how she got the idea for the film, what it took for a novice filmmaker to get it done, and where this powerhouse film is going. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, Linda Pence Gunter with the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story, Numbnuts of the Week for Outstanding Nuclear Boneheadedness, and more honest nuclear information than we'll ever hear about at King Charles' upcoming coronation. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, March 28, 2023, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Here in the U.S., in Minnesota, Xcel Energy is temporarily powering down one of the reactors in Monticello to repair a recurring leak of radioactive water discovered this week. State regulators are still monitoring the effects of an initial spill 4 months ago, which released 400,000 gallons of tritium-contaminated radioactive water. While Xcel is touting this as a non-emergency with no impact on the health safety of the public or plant personnel, local resident Megan Sanborn, who lives only 6 miles upstream from the nuclear plant, spoke for many in the area when she said, "No one from the state let residents know we had a nuclear leak, and when we don't have the ability to overcome a potential impact because no one told us, that's a big concern for residents." In Michigan, Holtec International, which purchased the Palisades nuclear power plant after it closed in 2022, has filed an application for funding through the U.S. Department of Energy to reopen the plant. The facility was shut down in May of 2022 after more than 50 years in operation, 10 more than the originally planned 40-year lifespan, and faces long-standing control rod problems. It originally closed down due to failure of a control rod drive seal. And the second time it shut down, it was to fix a leak related to these control rod drives. Holtec has acknowledged that there will be, quote, a number of hurdles, end quote, to reopening the plant, even if funding is secured. But David Lochbaum, who directs the Union of Concerned Scientists Nuclear Safety Project, said, other plants have similar designs and have at times in their past experienced problems, but they were able to find the problem and fixed it the first or at worst second time, whereas Palisades is at more than a dozen times. Something's wrong there, and the company has yet to figure out what it is and fix it. And Palisades spokesman Mark Savage admits they have yet to determine the cause of the leak. In North St. Louis, better news, as a state resolution has passed requesting that the Missouri Congressional Delegation expand the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act to include Missouri residents exposed to nuclear waste from the Manhattan Project. In the wording of this resolution, it includes the United States government damaged property and harmed residents of St. Louis, North St. Louis County, and St. Charles County through the improper handling of 2.3 million cubic yards of mixed radioactive contamination during the nation's race to produce the atom bomb in World War II and from the subsequent push to make more nuclear weapons during the Cold War. Missourians have reported diseases and cancers related to chronic exposure to ionizing radiation and exposure to chemical war waste. Local citizens have pushed for cleanup for years now, and finally it looks like it may be forthcoming. And in South Utah, near Bears Ears National Monument, new disclosures reveal that over 1.4 million pounds of radioactive waste from Estonia has arrived at the White Mesa Mill, just a few miles from the Ute Mountain Ute tribe's White Mesa community. The waste, which is contained in nearly 2,055-gallon drums, is supposed to be processed for final disposal at the White Mesa Mill, but no word as to where it goes once it leaves that facility. Now, here with her analysis of not only what's happening with Arctic drilling that the United States has approved, but further international implications as well, here's Linda Pence Gunter of Beyond Nuclear with this week's hot story.
Last week, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, known as the IPCC, published the final part of its mammoth sixth assessment report. It came replete with even more dire warnings than in previous reports. It's hard to understand just how dire these warnings need to get before our governments act, especially the world powers most responsible for causing the climate catastrophe in the first place. That would be China, the US, Russia, and India, for starters, the worst four CO2 emissions offenders. And yet, just as our climate Cassandras fired off what they called their final warning, the Biden administration announced it would allow oil and gas drilling in Arctic Alaska. Here's how the UK Daily, The Guardian, describes that project. The ConocoPhillips Willow project will be one of the largest of its kind on US soil, involving drilling for oil and gas at three sites for multiple decades. Remember in 2019 when youth climate activist Greta Thunberg reminded world leaders that our house is on fire? Yet here we are in 2023 with a US administration that professes to take the climate crisis seriously, failing utterly to understand that we cannot drill for one more drop of oil, ever, period. The IPCC climate scientists, realizing that proclaiming it too late to do anything would engender apathy or even numbness, tried one more time to encourage action. There are multiple feasible and effective options to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and adapt to human-caused climate change, and they are available now, they said in a press release. One of the few encouraging things to emerge from the IPCC report is that our world's climate experts do not see nuclear power as among those feasible and effective options. They strongly prioritize wind and solar power as the main pathway to achieving low or zero carbon emissions. The IPCC was already moving in this direction in its previous update, which hardly mentioned nuclear power at all. In this latest study, the word nuclear never appears in the narrative, and only once in a graph, illustrating just how ill-suited it is to climate mitigation. Nevertheless, we will continue to hear the nuclear lobby chant its desperate mantra, we need to do everything. Advancing this false formula is the only way nuclear power has a chance of being in the mix at all. But even a cursory glance at the empirical data shows beyond dispute that including nuclear in the mix diverts resources and time away from developing the solar and wind remedies that would actually work. We could get more carbon reductions faster for the same investment in renewables that our governments insist on squandering on nuclear power. As Stanford civil and environmental engineer Amory Lovins writes so succinctly, most US nuclear reactors now cost more just to run, including big repairs that trend upward with age, than their output can earn. They also cost more just to run than providing the same services by building and operating new renewables or by using electricity more efficiently. But we still aren't seeing the outrage where it really matters. We are still confronting climate deniers, and our governments are not taking the climate crisis nearly seriously enough. Our house is on fire, but instead of rushing for the fire hoses, they are bringing buckets. I'm Linda Pence-Gunter of Beyond Nuclear, reporting for Nuclear Hot Seat, and that's this week's hot story.
Over to Japan, where the head of Japan's wrecked Fukushima nuclear plant says details of the damage inside its reactor are only beginning to be known now, 12 years after it was hit by a massive earthquake and tsunami. This makes it difficult to foresee when or how the decommissioning will be completed. You think? And when it comes to nuclear energy, many Fukushima mayors are reluctant to take a stand. In December, the government made a dramatic shift in nuclear energy policy that would allow for construction of new reactors and extension of the operating life of those already built. The Asahi Shimbun, one of the four largest newspapers in Japan, polled 45 mayors from the Fukushima region, and while 19 were somewhat or totally opposed to a reversion to nuclear energy, 14 were somewhat or totally in favor. But mayors of six municipalities that either hosted the Fukushima nuclear reactors or are in close proximity did not take a clear stand on any of the questions in the survey, saying that taking a clear stand on nuclear issues might create division among local residents. To which the question must be asked, what local residents? While the government claims that Fukushima has started attracting new residents in response to promises of subsidies, discount housing, and work opportunities, there is no guarantee that these migrants will stay. And even though there is a loud ballyhoo going on about surfing in the region and even snow returning to Fukushima as a tourist attraction, to learn the truth of what it is like on the ground in Fukushima Prefecture, I suggest that you check out Nuclear Hot Seat number 611 for March 7, 2023, an extensive in-person report on what's actually happening on the ground in that prefecture from Beverly Findlay Kaneko. From firsthand experience, she paints a very different picture. Over to Ukraine, where on Monday, Britain confirmed that it was supplying Ukraine with ammunition which contained depleted uranium. The following day, Putin condemned British plans to send such ammunition to Ukraine, saying Moscow would be forced to respond accordingly as such weapons had, quote, a nuclear component. In a stunning display of tone-deaf semantics, British Foreign Secretary James cleverly, that is his name, said, there is no nuclear escalation. The only country in the world that is talking about nuclear issues is Russia, cleverly said, cleverly. The depleted uranium, or DU, is used in dart-like projectiles, which increases the ability to penetrate armor, as well as ignite on impact. But despite disclaimers, DU still possesses radioactive properties that can be very harmful to humans and is highly toxic, making it a dangerous weapon long after the engagement in which it is fired. It is considered by many to be the equivalent of a dirty bomb. Russian President Putin has said he would be able to position nuclear weapons in Belarus by the summer, while claiming that 10 Belarusian warplanes have already been retrofitted to carry Russian nuclear weapons, and that a storage facility for the warheads would be ready by July 1st. Putin insisted that his plan was no different from the American practice of positioning nuclear weapons in allied countries. In France, a report released by the French Court of Auditors highlighted the issues regarding the safety and operation of nuclear power plants because of the increasingly unstable supply of the water necessary for cooling reactors. Drought and low water levels caused some plants to be turned off temporarily last summer. The auditors warned that the 56 existing reactors, as well as the ones that are being planned, must be analyzed in the context of climate extremes such as prolonged droughts and rising water temperatures in rivers. And speaking of new nukes, including France's EDF in the equation,
nuclear hot seat, nuclear hot seat, nuclear hot seat, not nuts out of the week.
In Italy, French power group EDF, its Italian arm Edison, and Italy's Ansaldo Energia are planning to cooperate on the development of nuclear energy in Europe, specifically small modular nuclear reactors. But here's the thing. EDF has been having massive problems operating its plants in France, where at one point during this past summer, more than half of them were offline. And now more cracks are being found in pipes and welds in the reactors. Edison has been mismanaging the shutdown of San Onofre, leaving residents in Southern California at risk from its nuclear waste storage containers, which are only 5/8 of an inch thick, only 100 feet from the mean high tide of the Pacific Ocean, and each one of them carries a Chernobyl's worth of radioactivity. If you're trying to push a process forward, isn't it best to deal with people who have had success in the past as opposed to an entire string of failures? This agreement by Ansaldo also aims to restart a debate on the role of atomic energy in Italy. The country ceased using nuclear generation in 1987 after Italians voted against it in a referendum. And it's time to do it again, because the Three Stooges nuclear team of EDF, Edison, and Ansaldo, you are this week's
nuclear hot seat, numbnuts of the week.
In Thailand, Thai authorities found a radioactive cylinder that was reported missing earlier this month, but the bad news is that the object was no longer intact. The steel tube containing cesium-137 was found after authorities detected radioactive readings at a steel foundry. Unfortunately, the readings came from scrap metal that had already been compressed into cubes ready to be smelted, meaning that the container was cracked, and there's no telling how far the contents may have scattered. And the U.S. has opened a dialogue with Spain on decontamination of Palomares, where in 1966, a collision with the B-52 strategic bomber resulted in 4 thermonuclear bombs falling to the ground and contaminating 100 acres with americium and plutonium. 57 years, and they're only starting to talk about cleaning it up now. We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, the nuclear industry never lets up with their propaganda. Using prepared talking points, op-eds, talk show bookers, and other tactics to brainwash our politicians, reporters, and the public into giving them whatever they want, which is money, money, and more money. And let's face it, they've got all the money in the world to fund their PR agencies and their agenda. It's a business model with a terrific return on investment, because whatever millions the nukesters spend on their public relations propaganda, they stand to make billions of dollars back from taxpayers. That's why you need Nuclear Hot Seat. For almost 12 years, this show has been one of the only places where you can get a one-hour hit of honest nuclear information every week. Interviews with genuine experts, a roundup of international news, numbnuts, bad puns, a touch of musical theater. Where else can you find all this in a weekly counterbalance to the nuclear industry lies? But up against the unlimited financial resources of the nuclear industry, this show operates on a bake sale budget. And that budget is dependent on you, the listeners, to keep us going. That's why if you've come to value Nuclear Hot Seat's work, the time to support us with a tax-deductible donation would be right now. We make it easy. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the red donate button to help us with a donation of any size. You can make it one time, or you can set up a recurring donation for as little as $5 a month. Same as a cup of coffee and a nice tip here in the U.S. So go buy Nuclear Hot Seat a cup of coffee. We promise that I won't be drinking it. It will all go towards the show. So if you value the different perspective on nuclear information you get here every week, and want us to continue, please, do what you can now. And know that however much you can help, I'm deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now, here's this week's featured interview. Today is the 44th anniversary of the start of the nuclear meltdown at Three Mile Island near Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. I was there, 1 mile away while it happened, and the experience completely changed the trajectory of my life. For one thing, I would not be producing this program if I hadn't been there, and that's just a small piece of the changes that this experience wrought upon my life. But through all the years where I did my research, read books, viewed films and TV programs, interviewed genuine experts, no one seems to have addressed the human, emotional, personal toll that the accident and its aftermath extracted from the population. That is, until now. Radioactive, the women of Three Mile Island, rolls out the story of the 1979 accident through the eyes and experiences of four mothers from the community. It includes scientific information, of course, but the emphasis is on the human side of the story, the part that the nuclear industry leaves out as it cites statistics and spews false assurances of safety. The film is calm, understated, and ultimately devastating, and is already having an impact on those who have seen it, and these are still the early days. So it was with special interest and joy that I set up an interview with the director, writer, and producer of the film, Heidi Huttner. She is a professor of literature, sustainability, women's and gender studies at Stony Brook University, and a scholar of nuclear and environmental history, literature, film, and ecofeminism. Huttner chaired the Sustainability Studies program for 6 years and was associate dean in the School of Marine, Atmospheric Science, and Sustainability. She is the winner of the Sierra Club Long Island's 2015 Environmentalist of the Year Award, and there is much, much more, but let's get to it. I spoke with Heidi Huttner on Saturday, March
18, 2023. Heidi Huttner, it is terrific to have you here with us today on Nuclear Hot Seat.
So great to see you. I'm honored to be here once again.
This is, of course, about your new film, Radioactive, The Women of Three Mile Island. But before we get to the specifics of the film, let's find out a bit more about you. What has been your professional background and your field of focus?
I'm a professor at Stony Brook University in New York. And I teach in the English department, but I'm also affiliated with sustainability studies and women's and gender studies. And I was the director of sustainability studies for 5+ years. And I was a dean in the School of Atmospheric and Marine Sciences also during that time. So I have this very interdisciplinary background focused on environmental studies. And primarily of late, I've been really attuned to and engaged with nuclear studies. And that kind of led me to do the work I'm doing on the film.
What is your background as a filmmaker?
Zero. I did not go to film school. I never directed before a film, but I do have a background as a journalist. Most of my academic work has really shifted to doing journalism and storytelling. I also have a web series that is called Coffee with H Times 2. And on that, I did produce that. I wasn't on the other side of the camera, but I chose all the people that we interviewed and I planned out the interviews. So I got in the habit, I got very used to doing 30+ interviews on that site. At my website, HeidiHuttner.com, you can see it. And it's also on YouTube. I really love the process of doing on-screen interviews. And because this is my field and it was all sustainability and environment related, I so enjoyed bringing on, as I'm sure you do, bringing on people in a field that's so important to me and engaging with them. And I found I was very good at it. I could lead them through the arc of a story. I could kind of get to the heart of what their work is in a very succinct way. And I have a background in acting for many, many years ago and being in theater. So I'm very comfortable in front of the camera. I'm very aware of storytelling. Also in the classroom, it is storytelling. You know, you're presenting history and information in a way where you have to engage students. You know, I can see when they're falling asleep. I can see when they're excited. And so all of that, I think, works together. And then, of course, all the knowledge I came to the film with.
What gave you the idea to do a film on Three Mile Island?
Well, I sort of fell into Three Mile Island. I was already writing about various nuclear disaster sites and working with activist groups and studying this history all over the world. And I've written about Fukushima extensively. I've written about Rocky Flat in Colorado. We were there together, the Navajo Nation, and interviewed people there. So I had this plan that I was going to do a book, which got waylaid making the film, but I was going to have a chapter, and it started, it's in draft form, a chapter about various disaster locations focused on impacts on women and children, women's activism, women's history, which is a lot of my work, is also tied to the history of women and anti-nuclear activism, the science, the stories of the people on the ground. So I was actually giving a talk about my mother's work with Women Strike for Peace in Miami, where she was from and where the women she worked with were from. And she also co-founded a Freeze branch in Miami many years ago. And so she was sort of a longtime anti-nuclear activist from the 1950s. She and my dad worked with SANE, then my mother worked with Women Strike for Peace, and then they did anti-war work during the Vietnam War, civil rights work. But then when, after the Vietnam War was over, they got involved again with the Freeze movement. And so I was exposed to all of that. So I was on that journey of looking at women's history because I learned about my mother's story later in life. And I became really interested in women and anti-nuclear activism. So I'd gone to these different nuclear disaster sites and I'd written about them and studied them and researched them. And did some on-the-ground work with Japanese women with activism. So I was down in Miami, where my parents had lived when they were living, and I was giving a talk about my mother's anti-nuclear activism and women and anti-nuclear activism. And mysteriously, in the middle of the night, I couldn't sleep, and I get a ping on Facebook in a message box. Christine Lehman sends me a text message. I don't know her, but she reaches out and somehow she knows me through my anti-nuclear writing and work and environmental work. And she says, would you come to Three Mile Island to speak at the 39th anniversary? We're going to have an event and we're going to have speakers. And I was surprised by the invitation because how did she know who I was and how did she find me? And I hadn't planned to include Three Mile Island in my book, and I'd already started working on various places, as I mentioned before, Rocky Flats, Fukushima, and many other locations. So, of course, I agreed to come, and I actually asked if I could bring Cindy Folkers along with me. I said she knows a lot about women and science and girls and radiation impacts, and she said, sure. So at that point, I was already exploring the possibility of making a film. And I went around with my then co-director and cameraman, and we were actually filming at Indian Point and following Courtney Williams, who does a lot of work on pipelines there and nuclear dangers at Indian Point. And we went to a march, a big march about this, about the pipeline next to Indian Point, and we filmed it. And we thought, well, probably maybe we'll do someone local. I had an idea of doing multiple locations. I really hadn't figured it out yet. So then I get the call from Christine, and I said it to Martin, my partner then, you just bring your camera, we'll go to Three Mile Island. It's drivable from where I live, and it's relatively inexpensive to go to, and that was, we had no money at that point. So he agreed, and we drove, and we took his, he's a phenomenal camera person and cinematographer, and we thought, we need to find action. I mean, filming a panel is not very interesting. It's kind of too academic. So Christine had a list of activities that she sent us that were happening around the anniversary. And one of them was the 4 a.m. vigil.
Yes, I know it well.
I'd never heard of it. I didn't know what it was. And we thought, well, we should go to that. That might be interesting. Who knows? I really knew nothing. You know, I knew about it in general terms. I just hadn't gone there and didn't know anybody personally. So we arrived at about 10 p.m. and we went to sleep for a couple of hours. We got up at 2. We started driving around trying to find it. It was dark, for one thing, and it was misty. And all there was this sort of white Exelon sign on a dark road with no traffic You really couldn't see anything. You certainly couldn't see the towers because of the darkness and the mist. And so there's this little large white lit up sign saying Exelon, but nothing about nuclear. You know, I love that. There's no mention of nuclear or anything. So we figured that must be it, but there was no one there. We drove back and forth and we just couldn't figure out, is this the entrance? We went to park on a side street, and lo and behold, a car drives up full of four mothers, Paula Kinney, Joyce Karate, Beth Drosba, and Linda Barash. We didn't know them. And they drove by and they rolled down their window. And I said, is this a location for the vigil? And they laughed and they said, yes. And we filmed a little bit that morning. We still weren't sure this was going to be it. I mean, we just were figuring out what was our film going to be about nuclear and women, but would it be there? I didn't know. And Martijn had his camera and he was kind of winding around us in the dark, and this train crashes through. We take a moment of silence, the whole thing. It's very dramatic. And it was a tiny little group. And that was sort of very touching. How few people were there. You know, it was like six people or something. That was the moment. And I knew it. And I had chills while it was taking place. And I could feel he was getting it. He was getting that moment. And we went back and we looked at the footage in the middle of the night. And I had tears in my eyes. I said, this is it. This is our story.
You had taken contact information for the four women at that point?
Oh, yeah. We went to breakfast. They invited us to breakfast at 5 a.m. in the or 6, whatever, at this diner. There's nobody there but us. And they said, that's where they always go.
How did you determine that these four women were going to be the focus of the film?
I didn't know immediately. I had it in my mind, you know, I heard all the stories about Mary Osborne Stamos, and I'd seen her, you know, in archival footage. And we did videotape her and interview her extensively. And she's lovely and she has great stories to tell. And we have got the images of the plants with the deformities and heard a lot of her stories. And we interviewed a lot of other people, but something about those four mothers was just, we were magnets, you know. It was just like we couldn't get away from it. We interviewed Abigail Kohler, who had been in the womb at the time of the meltdown. And she has an incredible story. I mean, there were a lot of amazing stories, but something about those folks and my connection to them, there's such a strong bond. There's so much love. We just hit it off so well. And it was magic. I mean, the filming was magic.
Once you secured the cooperation of the women, how did you proceed from there? I mean, there's some incredible footage. We're used to seeing very formal situations, as you mentioned, at conferences, at panel discussions. And you've got all of these women in the kitchen over coffee and baked goods talking the way women tend to talk to each other in a kitchen, which I thought was extraordinary. How did you proceed to get that footage and so much more with them?
This kind of filming is about trust. And they said to me, you know, they've had many journalists come and go, but they didn't feel that the people who came really cared about them. They were coming to get a story. And they trusted me. My sense is that they felt my true intentions, which were to really help with this problem, which is why I'm making the film. And it was never, you know, I want money or I want fame. I mean, who would mind it? But actually, I used to say the reason I want the fame, if it should come, is to continue to help the cause. I'd like to make more films. And I want it to gain attention for the cause. That's why I'm doing this. I made a commitment to spend the rest of my years that I'm capable to help as much as I can in way that I can. You know, we all have different skill sets. And I think I'm a good storyteller. And I'm also really aware and obsessed with very visible media. And I feel like we have such a crowded media right now between all of the social apps, and more than ever, I want to crack that to get to people because they're missing deeper information or deeper research. I mean, there's a couple of reasons I felt it was really important to do this. I remember when I was a child and we sat down and watched The Day After on TV and we watched Testament. And I remember sitting on the, you know, we used to watch TV in my parents' bedroom, sitting on the floor and just being deeply, deeply moved and shocked by the after effects of nuclear war. And then, of course, China Syndrome and Silkwood. And I teach all of those in my classroom. And they really, really affected me. And I think more than anything, those films woke me up. So I know the power of filmmaking, good filmmaking. I was committed to doing it in a really high level way. I didn't want to do it as just a very simple independent film that would reach people who already know and might just show it in community groups. Not knocking that. But I feel like we desperately need media that will reach everyone, not just those who are environmentalists or not those just on the left wing, sort of the obvious targets. But I wanted to touch hearts the way I'd been touched as a child. I was not moved by my parents ranting and raving. They were ranting and raving activists, no question. But what moved me were the films they took me to see. That's what I've never forgotten. I can only do what moves me. And so I really aimed to make a film like a Silkwood, even though it's a documentary. And I see in my classroom that the combination, because I teach those films in my classroom, the combination of the facts and literature, like Full Body Burden, or, you know, the moving personal story, which, you know, Kristen Iverson's book, Full Body Burden, has the combination of the science and the history and the personal narrative. I can see with my students what works. That really is very successful. And those films are very moving. So that's a long answer, but that's what I'm aiming to do. And those mothers in that, to come back to that original point, they have so much heart and they're so alive, even many years later, from when the height of the drama was taking place between the meltdown and then the restart, which is really that time frame we talk about in the film. And the restart was when reactor number one, which had been shut down during the meltdown, the nuclear industry wanted to just turn it right back on right away. And the community was just freaked out. They didn't want it turned back on. They wanted, someone needed to look at what had happened first with reactor two, right? So yeah, those women, they moved me to tears. They moved my producers to tears. They moved Martine down the camera to tears, and their interaction and the relationship to each other. And I think we just, you know, some people you connect with more than others, right? I think there was a really deep, and they must be, trust me, because they've given me years of their lives. I know all of their families. I've been with them on holidays, you know, we've intruded. I felt like it was quite an intrusion, but they let us in. It was a miracle. It was a beautiful, beautiful, and it continues to be a beautiful relationship.
One thing that really impressed me about the documentary is that it wasn't the usual talking heads kind of activist film that can be very powerful and very effective, but it's been done. This was much more low-key. It was personal. And the scientific information was there, but it was couched in human terms as to what happened with this woman. And I found, if anything, the lead factor in the telling of the story was the very human fear of not knowing and suspecting that those who know are not willing to tell you because it will reflect badly upon them. How intentional was that as a focus, or is that just something that came out intrinsically as you were filming?
It was entirely intentional. You've just said it perfectly. I made a film that I would want to see. I care about people. I do want to know the facts. I mean, this was incredibly well-researched. That's why it took me so long, actually. And I've been told for an indie filmmaker, this is not long. You know, 5 years is not long. But, you know, if you have a ton of money and you're a news station, you're not going to stay there for 5 years. You go in and out, right? But I had to do very deep research. I needed to know for sure that I understood everything fully. There were no inaccuracies. I wasn't missing anything. But the most important thing to me, you know, you have to have that. That's like the foundation of the house. This is not a made-up story. It's a real story with a lot of things that have never been told before and have been hidden and buried and covered up and lied about. But it's the human that makes us care, because these are real people who live through this. And I feel like you turn on, you know, you watch any of these older, you know, news stories, they're not about the people. They're about the technicality of, well, the valve and this much might have been released or this wasn't released or, you know, governor such and such had such and such. But there isn't, what did those people have to live through? Because that's, we don't ever hear about that. You know, it's a very male version of history, the technical, the business, How did the president react? Very factual, like this happened on this day and this happened on this day. But what really happened is the people who live there and what they had to experience. And there's very little information about that. When I interviewed Lake Barrett, for instance, he was on the commission at the time, and he was one of the commissioners, and he went there. He made so many points that were incorrect, but one of the ones he made that really upset me, more than the technical sort of fudges, but I'll say fudges, but when he said, well, people didn't, and this didn't end up in the film, but people could have left or they didn't have to stay. That's absolutely not true. Linda Brash and her husband, Lou, who was the husband who left during those few days because he had a job interview in Texas, and he was actually hired at a much better, bigger radio station in Texas and wanted to go, right? But then the meltdown happened. He ran home. He's the one who said he had a taste of metal in his mouth when he arrived. But they couldn't sell their house. So he had quit his job in Harrisburg. So he had no job. He couldn't take the job in Texas, and they could not sell their house. So he was unemployed for a year with a new baby, a 9-year-old son, and a wife was also unemployed. I mean, these are the things we, you know, how desperate they must have felt. Not only were they terribly worried about the health of their baby, she hadn't given birth yet. So can you imagine? She's pregnant. They have a little boy, and now they have no job. And they can't leave. Nobody comes there to help them with real estate issues. Oh, they're going to show up, the government or a company that did this and help the people. No, no. And there were people who couldn't get out. They didn't have a car. You don't hear those stories.
That was my situation on the third day. I was visiting. I was with friends, but they were at work. They had one car. The car was in use. There was no public transportation. And suddenly I hear the announcement going down the street, close your doors and windows and don't go outside unless you absolutely have to. And the phones didn't work because they were all overloaded. So On the ground, there was a very different story being lived by the people as opposed to what was being put out into the world, which you're right, were the technical pieces of information, but not on the ground. And while the officials are fond of saying nobody died at Three Mile Island, well, nobody died on the island on that day at that time. That doesn't mean that health wasn't impacted and people didn't die through the years. And what they were dealing with back then is still in continuation in evolution being dealt with right now.
Yeah. And those stories about the children. One child I interviewed, well, adult now, said that the teacher announced the atomic bomb had gone off in the classroom. Right? I mean, there's so many stories like these that, you know, the story that Beth tells about her daughter running home with a paper bag over her head with slits in it. You know, as a parent, it makes you gasp. The son who threw up this very green bile, the child who's left at the school because they told the parents not to go to the school. So they listened, but then that was the only child who wasn't picked up. I mean, it's just outrageous. And then people did have metallic taste. People did have experiences that you see and listen and hear in the film that Eileen Mioko Smith, we use her oral narratives that she recorded. We use some of those. She's just a Japanese woman writer visiting from Japan and says, the stories I'm hearing here are not what you hear in the news. So that's what was really touching. And the moms were so willing. And they had also, their story was so compelling because they came together as a result of the meltdown. And they became activists as a result of the meltdown. And they were the happy, leave it to Beaver moms. They loved their lives. You know, the doors were open and the kids came in and played. And it was just idyllic. And then suddenly all of that is shattered. And their neighbors, they live in walking, mostly live in walking distance to each other. So those stories to me were really so powerful. And that's what I'm interested in telling as a filmmaker and writer.
What did you find most shocking or extraordinary in the information that you uncovered?
So much. I'm going to name two. The science, and people have to come watch the film to really witness the discussion about it. The science that Aaron Datesman's doing, that we're doing together. I mean, that's phenomenal. You know, a study has come out of this film and we film it in it. So the process of doing that was amazing because I'm on the study, which is insane because I'm not a scientist, but I'm the person on the ground with the people. And then also our whistleblower, what he reveals, what he saw, what he heard, what he witnessed, and the major cover-ups happening inside that plant and what he had to say about the industry and how they absolutely knew there was a meltdown. Everybody, he said, in the industry knew there was a meltdown. And then to later claim they didn't know, it was just bogus. But he was there physically and he was doing measuring of radiation. And that's the other cool thing I have to say. The piece that I loved about doing this was it was like a spider's web. One person led me to the next, led me to the next, led me to the next. And having the time and space, not being in a rush because I had some editor or I had my boss or my producer at NBC or whatever, telling me you got to hurry up and finish. And each person required developing a very personal relationship with. People aren't just going to tell you all this stuff because you knock on their door. Hi. You build trust and then they start, you don't even know what they know, right? So you have to get to know them and then they start to tell you things and then you go back again and again and again and more becomes revealed.
There was a tremendous specificity in the information shared. And I think that's one of the things that contributed to it being very even in tone. It's not hysterical. It doesn't go through huge emotional spikes, but the cumulative impact of what one learns, I'm on the verge of tears right now, just remembering it, is so ultimately powerful and persuasive to somebody who perhaps never even heard about Three Mile Island or has only heard that, well, nobody died and it wasn't a problem. So there, Missy, don't worry your pretty little head about it. It was the understated nature that made it roar so loudly in my head when I heard it. So I want to find out, Radioactive, The Women of Three Mile Island, is not yet available online. What is the rollout plan that you have? I know it's had a few showings already. What is the plot line for the availability of the film?
We are first going to festivals, and that list is growing every day. I can barely keep up with it myself. The best thing people can do, as much as I post on social media, we don't always get everything. So I would suggest that people sign up at our website, radioactivethefilm.com, and we are doing the festival route first. So for the next 6 months or so, we are going to festivals. We're winning awards. I know there's some more awards coming that I can't announce. At our premiere, we won Best Documentary.
Where was that?
That was in New York City at Dances with Films. It's a wonderful, wonderful festival. You know, I was just worried that people wouldn't get up and walk out. You know, you don't know until it was the first big screen viewing. And people were, it was an amazing audience. And people just, you could hear the sniffles, you could hear the laughing, major standing ovation. Everyone just kept getting phone calls and got a fantastic review. I've gotten really nice reviews. So that was lovely. And that kind of was like, phew, okay, it works. And a big screen, you know, you work on it and you work on it on your computer. It's a very different thing. So that's the first plan. And then we expect to air on a, what we call SVOD. We're talking to various people about that. That's, you know, the big guns who are streamers, but nothing's secured for sure yet, but we're working on it. There's also, you know, various pay-per-views, which we'll probably do as well. It turns out that I'm learning this whole world. They like sometimes, depending on who buys it, to put it on pay-per-view first, get as much money they can from the pay-per-view, and then put it into the streamer that you're paying monthly on. We may also have a theatrical release. It just depends who ends up securing the deal with us. But what I've been doing also is, and people have been inviting us, to come do showings at commercial theaters. So, you know, wonderful independent commercial. We're doing a few of those. And what I tell the activist groups and the community groups who would like us to come, for now, we really need to show the film in those venues and get press. We will eventually, once all that's accomplished, we will absolutely go and speak to community groups and universities. But that, we have to do this. I have wonderful producers, Joanne Darshow, who's actually, as producer, won an Academy Award and a Palme d'Or. So she's knows what she's doing. She's amazing. And she was also the attorney in the film who did the Restart case and took it all the way to the Supreme Court when she was 25 years old. But now she's in our film. She's an incredible advisor. I worked with her really closely on the story, the legal story. And she's a superb producer. So she's kind of guiding me and other people. We have other actually phenomenal team of people.
Looking ahead with the greatest possible optimism, in order to be eligible for Oscar consideration, the film either needs to win an award on what is currently a very short list of major film festivals or open in one of six major metropolitan areas and run for at least 7 consecutive days in a commercial cinema theater with screenings 3 times a day. And that would be Los Angeles, New York, Atlanta, San Francisco Bay, Chicago, or Miami. That's what you need to do before the end of 2023 to be eligible for Oscar consideration. What plans are you putting in place to accomplish that?
Well, I can't really say right now. I will let you know, but I would just shout out to all the folks out there who are knocking on my door. And there's a lot of you, and I adore you. If you want to help us, because I'm pretty much a one woman band here a lot of the time, doing more work than one can possibly imagine and teaching full time. I would just say, if you want us to come, help us do that. Because people invite us to come and I'm like, yeah, but we're not doing that. I can't. It takes a lot of energy, even just to go to a small group. Time, planning, money, effort, getting it set up, my time, which is very limited right now. So if anyone would like to participate in those kinds of screenings, shout me out, write to me. And we definitely will be coming to the groups that need us to come. You know, that's my heart and soul, but we're working on it.
My hope about an Oscar eligibility is that then it becomes available to all of those who vote in that category, which means wider distribution in a hardcore filmmaking community where you have no idea the influence you might have on dramatic films, on the made-for-Netflix programs, on TV series. You have no idea what the influence would be, and that would be to get it to that sweet spot right in the middle of the professional filmmaking community. So I'll put my 2 cents in on that. If there's anything I can do to help you bring it, certainly to Los Angeles, I'm in.
Fabulous. Join us, LeBay. I would love your support. And I know you're there all the time. I feel you and I appreciate you. And I appreciate all the work you do, which is phenomenal. And we expect to be in LA, but there's no reason we can't do more in LA. But there's no reason not to work on getting into commercial theaters. And that's a great idea. And we'd love to have you join us on that. That'd be great.
I have a few calls I can make and I'll put that out and see what information I can get. I understand also that Radioactive, the Women of 3 Mile Island, will now be shown at the International Uranium Film Festival in May in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. I am going to be there and attending. It's definite. We confirmed this week. Will I be seeing you down there?
I have to let you know. Go to our website and you'll also see much more. You can see our trailer and follow us. And you get news about our awards and all that if you sign up for our mailing list.
We will link to what we can on Nuclear Hot Seat under this episode. I am so thrilled that you have done this. I am so tremendously proud of you, the work you have done. I understand what it takes to pull together a production like this. And hats off, especially since this is your first effort. We look forward to many more. And for now, Heidi Huttner, congratulations on the completion and the outreach of Radioactive, the Women of 3 Mile Island, and my gratitude to you for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Well, thank you so much. I'm really honored to be here.
Professor, writer, producer, and director, Heidi Huttner. Radioactive, the Women of 3 Mile Island, is not yet available for purchase or streaming, but there is an ever-lengthening list of locations where the film will be screened. It's up on the website, radioactivethefilm.com. That's where you can also send an email to Heidi at hjhuttner@gmail.com if you wish to pursue getting a screening in your area. So if you're interested in booking the film or helping with its promotion, let her know.
Activists, shout out.
There's a petition up at change.org to stop 1 million gallons of radioactive waste being dumped into the Hudson River. The water is contaminated with tritium, which cannot be removed, and can cause unknown long-term health effects in our community, children, wildlife, and the hundreds of thousands of people who will be drinking that water. We'll have a link up to that petition on our website, NuclearHotSeat.com, under this episode, number 614. On March 23rd, 81-year-old Dennis Duval became the second American to enter a German prison for actions demanding that U.S. nuclear bombs stationed at Germany's Buchel NATO base be withdrawn. The longtime nuclear disarmament activist, U.S. Air Force veteran, and members of Veterans for Peace said, It is my right and my duty to work towards the abolition of nuclear weapons, and it is the responsibility of the German government to sign and ratify the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons and to ensure the prompt removal of U.S. B-61 thermonuclear weapons from Buchel's NATO base. You can write to him. We will put the address up on our website and also have a link where you can gain more information and further updates if he gets moved to another prison. And a reminder that for this anniversary of Three Mile Island, 44 years since it began, you can read about my story and what it led to in my book, Yes, I Glow in the Dark, 1 Mile from Three Mile Island to Fukushima and Nuclear Hot Seat. You can find it by clicking on the link on our website. We've got a nice picture of the cover there. Or you can just go straight to Amazon or to your favorite independent bookstore to order your own copy. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, March 28, 2023. Material for this week's show has been researched and compiled from nuclear-news.net, deunrenard.wordpress.com, beyondnuclear.org, NIRS.org, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICANW.org, the IAEA, Ed Lyman of the Union of Concerned Scientists, Dr. Paul Dorfman, Radical.org, NYSenate.gov, House.mo.gov, CNBC.com, ClimateCrocs.com, GrandCanyonTrust.org, KnoxNews.com, TheGlobeAndMail.com, Asahi.com, News.ctgn.com, Euronews.com, VeteransToday.com, NYTimes.com, and, as always, the captured and compromised by the industry they're supposed to be regulating, Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Our thanks to Linda Pence Gunter for the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story. You deserve to not miss a single episode of Nuclear Hot Seat. And the easiest way to do that is to sign up to get one email every week that will contain a link and a brief rundown of some of the information in the show. We make it easy. Go to nuclearhotseat.com, scroll down for the yellow box, put in your first name and an email address, and every week you will get that one email. It's the easiest way for you to keep tabs on what the nuclear monster in the world is up to. You can also help us with information. If you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need your help. Anything you can do, we appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2023, Libby Halevi and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, the website, and if you can throw in the names of whoever it is that you quote, including me, that would be appreciated as well. This is Libby Halevi, producer and host of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you we can always come up with the date that a nuclear emergency begins, but we can never come up with the date that it's over, because once it starts, it's never over. There you have it. You have just had your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all still in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.